nuclear war. That's the fear, isn't it? That the U.S. and Russia or South Korea or China will get into it, lose tempers, escalate to a point of no return, push a button, and then bye-bye biosphere. But while our attention has been focused on those more prominent nuclear weapons-possessing saber-rattling states, a possible nuclear Armageddon has been brewing elsewhere, between India and Pakistan, which both also have nuclear weapons. Tensions between these two traditional enemy states has been growing. Last night, India attacked Pakistan, and Pakistan said it had shot down 5 Indian fighter jets in the worst fighting in more than 2 decades between these nuclear-armed enemies. How bad could it get if India and Pakistan decide to go to war? Listen as a genuine expert, a board member of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, addressed the United Nations just last week, where he told us that if nuclear war breaks out,
and according to a landmark study published in 2022, 6 billion people, 3/4 of humanity, will starve in the first 2 years. The study stopped at 2 years. The famine would continue, and we do not know what the ultimate death toll would be. The same study showed that even a much smaller war, as might take place between India and Pakistan, will cause enough climate disruption to trigger a famine that will kill 1/4 of humanity, 2 billion people globally, in the first 2 years.
That was Dr. Ira Helfand, board member of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, at the United Nations addressing the 2026 review conference of the parties to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. It took place at UN headquarters in New York on April 30th. And his warning of what the consequences of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan would be is a prescient warning of how close we are to being blown off that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, against the backdrop of escalating tensions between nuclear-armed states Pakistan and India, our featured interview is with General C. Robert Keller, retired. He is the former commander of U.S. Strategic Command and explains how the nuclear chain of command works should the commander-in-chief give the nuclear launch order. This is an excerpt from an interview he gave last December at the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C. Then we'll present Dr. Ira Helfand's opening speech to the United Nations at the Review Conference of the Parties to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT. It took place at UN headquarters in New York just last week. His brief and clear explanation of the consequences to the world of what would happen as a result of nuclear war between India and Pakistan, or any other nuclear states, provides a prescient warning of what we might be up against, and soon. If there's time, we will also have nuclear news from around the world, and more honest nuclear information than made its way into the Met Gala. All of it coming up in just a few moments. In light of last night's events, the show has been re-recorded and re-edited. So today is Wednesday, May 7, 2025, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, this week calculated that the quote-unquote modernization cost of the U.S. nuclear arsenal will be at least $1 trillion annually over the next 10 years. The biennial CBO Nuclear Forces Review, mandated by Congress in 2014, found significant cost increases for all three legs of the U.S. nuclear triad: intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear-armed submarines, and nuclear-capable long-range bombers. The increased cost of these programs rose $190 billion since 2023, totaling $946 billion. Proponents of this modernization include the Los Alamos National Laboratory, which has argued that it's essential to ensure that the threat of nuclear weapons remains credible amid a changing geopolitical landscape. In a fact page about plutonium pits, which are the triggering cores of nuclear weapons, Los Alamos called the replacements a, quote, precaution to avoid potential changes to the capability of nuclear weapons as plutonium ages. Side note, plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years and an effective radiological life of at least 250,000 years. So how old does it have to be before it ages out? Or are they just talking about the quality of the workmanship that turns the plutonium into the triggering pit? $1 trillion a year for nukes. No wonder the U.S. can't have nice things. We have links to two articles dealing with the Golden Dome Missile Defense Shield, a proposed system meant to protect the continental U.S. against ballistic, hypersonic, and advanced cruise missiles. But it has its fair share of issues out of the gate, including its enormous price tag, potential effectiveness, and even feasibility. The article from The Hill, entitled Five Things to Know as Trump Rolls Out Golden Dome Missile Defense Shield, includes project likely to exceed GOP funding, Musk's role is under increased scrutiny, questions emerge on the technology's feasibility, and lawmakers question vulnerability issues. The other article, from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, is headlined, Trump wants denuclearization and a golden dome. He can't have both. Linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 723. Last Friday, May 2nd, the Trump administration and DOGE unceremoniously fired vital personnel at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. This attack is catastrophic for thousands of sick and dying nuclear workers and their families who depend on the Energy Employee Occupational Illness Compensation Program. I won't go through the acronym. This is a bipartisan mandatory spending program enacted by Congress in 2000 that provides sick nuclear weapons workers with medical care and compensation when it is determined that occupational exposure to ionizing radiation and toxic chemicals caused cancer and other conditions. It covers workers at 380 nuclear sites across the country, from days of the Manhattan Project through the Cold War to the present day. Calls and letters to Congress are being requested. In Japan, there has been a tracking of international responses to the Fukushima water release, both the science and the politics. In Asian countries, the U.S., European Union, U.K., and Russia. We will link to that report. In Ukraine, despite the claims of International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Grossi that Zaporizhzhia's nuclear reactors could restart within months of a ceasefire and the plant could be fully operational in a year, questionable operations may be dooming the sixth nuclear reactor site. Russian troops captured it barely 2 weeks into the 2022 invasion, and under their control, it has suffered 3 years of occupation and frequent near misses that threaten radiological disaster. The promise of a rapid restart at Zaporizhzhia quickly faded amid daily and deadly Russian attacks on Ukrainian cities. Even the chief executive at Energoatom, Ukraine's nuclear power utility, acknowledged serious technical challenges, including deferred maintenance and a dearth of cooling water. According to Ukrainian, European, and U.S.-based experts interviewed by the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, say that Russia's occupation of the plant may have so badly damaged it that repairs could take years and cost billions of dollars. Particular problems include potential tilting of the reactor buildings and the integrity of the complex and relatively fragile steam generators. And even if there is a lasting cessation of hostilities, restarting Zaporizhzhia's reactor generator units may cost more than Ukraine is able to spend. In light of the nuclear vulnerabilities that surfaced when Russia invaded Ukraine, in the UK, a worrying new report warned that Britain's nuclear infrastructure is increasingly vulnerable to military attack as global tensions rise. This study by the Royal United Services Institute urges military and political leaders to prepare for scenarios in which nuclear infrastructure comes under direct threat. It further warns that the use of military force near or against nuclear facilities represents an under-addressed threat to international peace and civilian safety. And in Brussels, the International Atomic Energy Agency convened a summit to build momentum to triple nuclear generation by 2050. But banks balked at the eye-watering cost of doing so. Former U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, after listening to a panel of international lenders explain why they're unwilling to provide the $5 trillion the industry needs by mid-century, said, "If the bankers are uniformly pessimistic, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy." The newest reactor in the European Union, Olkiluoto 3 in Finland, started generating power last year, more than a decade late and three times over budget. Similarly, in the U.S., Southern Company's Vogtle facility came in 7 years behind schedule and $16 billion over estimates. European Investment Bank Vice President Thomas Ostro said, "While the world's biggest multilateral lender won't close the door on nuclear, it recommends that countries needing power quickly focus on renewables and energy efficiency." Ya think? We'll have this week's featured interview, as well as today's pronouncements from anti-nuclear groups about the conflict between India and Pakistan, in just a moment. But first, I remember watching the harrowing 1983 TV movie The Day After, about a fictional conflict between NATO and the Warsaw Pact that rapidly escalated into a full-scale nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. In early scenes, people are going about their lives as, in the background, radio news reports follow the ever-escalating conflict, and nobody pays any attention until the inevitable happens. Is that what's happening now? And if so, how are we to know? If mainstream media is covering the situation between Pakistan and India, it's probably not much beyond echo chamber headlines and obvious talking points. I do not expect that the outcry from worldwide peace and anti-nuclear organizations will be mentioned, let alone featured. But we are not only the real story, we represent the way out of the problem. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat, to give you the oppositional perspective, a consistent coverage of nuclear issues with context and continuity in language even nuclear newbies can understand. We interview genuine experts and frontline activists because we want you to understand what we are up against and what any one of us can do about it. But to keep the show running, we need your support. Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without your donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, the time to donate is now. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. So don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate and know that whatever you can do, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. What happens if the commander-in-chief actually calls for nuclear weapons to be used, what we colloquially call pushing the button? There is a human chain of command that must respond. Military men who not only accept and support the existence of nuclear weapons, but are in place to be part of deploying them. It is rare that we get to listen to the thinking of those who have had direct involvement with the inside of this nuclear launch system, let alone one who is willing to talk about it in front of a room full of journalists. That's what happened last December at the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C., a session entitled Nuclear Weapons, Then and Now, in Space and on Earth, featured General C. Robert Keller, USAF, retired, who is a former commander of U.S. Strategic Command. He was interviewed in front of that room filled with 130 reporters by W.J. Bill Hennigan, correspondent for the New York Times opinion section. While I may not agree with General Keller's views on the need for nuclear weapons and deterrence, I respect the sober clarity and honesty he brought to this discussion and feel it is important for the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat to be able to hear what he has to say. This interview was recorded on December 6, 2024, and General Keller starts with a disclaimer.
I am no longer wearing a uniform, which means that everything I say to you at this point is my personal opinion. I don't represent the Air Force or STRATCOM or the Department of Defense or anyone except myself. So I will give you my perspective as a military officer, and that is a perspective that is non-political. So I'll offer my thoughts on the subjects today and would appreciate you understanding that these are my personal perspectives based on a career in this kind of work and the insights that I think I've gained. I need to set the stage also for a little bit of perspective from my behalf. President Reagan and President Gorbachev, if you remember, famously said nuclear wars cannot be won and must not be fought. And in 39 years of active service, I never met anyone in uniform who disagreed with that. The question is, how do we do it? And so the United States has chosen to take on this paradox of the nuclear age, which is in order to prevent the use of nuclear weapons, you have to be prepared to use them. And that's called deterrence. And so our entire policy setup in the United States of America is deterrence, that we want to have a force that is seen by any adversary as capable of holding at risk those things that they value the most under any condition. And when I entered the Air Force and was assigned to an ICBM unit in Great Falls, Montana, our day-to-day mission was readiness. Make sure that we were ready to respond to presidential command if that ever became necessary. And there was a sense of urgency in the Cold War. We had an identifiable adversary who was sworn to destroy us. Said it publicly more than once. Remember, well, you don't remember this. I barely remember it either, but Khrushchev pounding his shoe on the table at the United Nations saying, "We will bury you." And every minute of every day, we lived believing that this could be the minute that they would try to destroy us. And so, as time passed in the Cold War and that sense of urgency softened some on my watch, we eventually got to the point where, as I think everybody knows, the Soviet Union collapsed on its own without anybody having to fire a shot. And we all kind of patted ourselves on the back and said, deterrence worked. Never mind the fact that the Russians still retained the capability, even after the Cold War, to destroy us and retain that capability right now today. Do I think they'll do it today? Well, no, I don't. But a mentor of mine always said, when you're looking at an adversary, you've got to look at capability and intent. I don't think the Russians intend to launch a massive nuclear attack on the United States today, but they could. They don't intend to, but they have the capability to, and as long as they do, you have to deter it. That's the position that we've taken. So, at the end of the Cold War, I think there was a great exhale of breath. And for a time, it appeared as though what people in those days called the peace dividend would play out. It's not what happened, although today that sense of urgency, I think, is still not the same as it was in the Cold War. And so that shapes the way our forces are postured today, our nuclear forces, the way they are postured. The fact that we have taken all of the bombers off of an immediate nuclear response kind of a posture, which happened in 1992, and the supporting tankers aren't there. We stood down most of our airborne command and control organization. We have some that are still on alert, but we basically took a step back from what people described as this, which I think wrongfully they describe as a hair trigger, which we didn't have then, don't have now, and won't have. So what's different today? Well, one of the things that's different is the triad today, right now as we sit here, is really a dyad. We have ICBMs and submarines in a ready-to-use posture for the president to use if necessary. And by the way, the United States policy on this today is that we would consider using nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances involving vital national interests. Extreme circumstances. So I think that there's a difference. We've had remarkable policy continuity from the Cold War to today. There have been some evolutionary changes in policy, not revolutionary changes in U.S. policy. But I think that we have basically stepped back from the sense of urgency, even though we have forces that are ready to use. And so today, those forces, while there are still some forces available to use, they are far smaller in number. They don't include bombers unless the president ordered them back into a nuclear posture. And in general terms, I think the reductions that have occurred through arms control, the reductions that have occurred through other presidential initiatives and other things that we and the Russians have done have made a positive difference in our security. But today, we now find ourselves in a different situation, and that is what some have called the return to great power competition, or others have called the two nuclear peer problem. And when you look at what China is doing, for example, Russia, it's an interesting case study in and of itself. We could spend a couple of seminars on what's happening with Russia, but you know, they're rattling their nuclear saber just about every day, and they still retain the capability to destroy the United States quickly if they chose to do that, and they retain a vast number of theater level or tactical, what some people call tactical nuclear weapons. What's really different is that the Chinese have decided that our strategic choices to have a triad make sense. And so they have decided that they are going to have one as well. They are building ICBM silos. They are doing other things that you all are reporting on, as a matter of fact, and I'm glad you are. They are upgrading their nuclear systems. They're upgrading their weapons. They're upgrading their command and control systems. And in fact, if you haven't read it, the Congressional Commission on the Strategic Posture of the U.S., which I think is what it was called, unfortunately was released at about the same time in October of 2023 that Hamas invaded Israel.
And so, what happened there? I hadn't heard about
that.
That's
not much going on there, right? So I think it would be interesting reading for all of you if you haven't read it. It does a very good job, I think, about capturing this issue about something that we didn't face in the Cold War. We had a single nuclear peer adversary that we understood, and it took us a long time to understand them. But by the end of the Cold War, we understood what the Soviet nuclear program was all about and what their forces could do and what their command and control looked like and how we thought they would intend to use them and all of the pieces that go with that. Not so much with the Chinese. There are lots of questions out there about what their intentions really are. And while this is part of their stated objectives to become a world-class power again, they think restoring their position as a world-class power, as I understand it, includes an element that will be a nuclear deterrent of their own. And so how do we deal with that? What must we do? Is our modernization effort sufficient, and the Posture Commission offered that it may not be. So I think we've got some challenges ahead of us here, facing a new set of world conditions.
A lot of those ideas are coming back, right? The Strategic Posture Commission, you know, I know that they are sensitive to this criticism, but it was largely seen as advocating for a build-up. They don't make this stated about, you know, going past New START numbers, but it certainly bolstered that argument. You also see conversations about putting the bombers back on alert. And one of the things that you said, we don't have a hair trigger alert, but it's pretty close. You know, there are two officers sitting in, hundreds of capsules across the planes. And, you know, they're ready and willing to launch if they're ever given an order. That might not be hair trigger by your assessment, but to many others, I think it doesn't take that much to get the system going. And I think one of the things that surprises people, and one of the things that we've learned through writing the series At the Brink, is how much power that the president actually has when it comes to nuclear weapons. It's almost the president's own arsenal. His power is absolute. And I think with the election of Donald Trump, people have a lot of questions, as we saw at the end of his first administration, about, you know, the checks and balances and sole authority. You were in the seat at STRATCOM at a time where I don't think that those questions were being asked as often. But if you could you kind of enlighten us a little bit about, do you see an issue with sole authority? Do you think that's time to revise that? Yeah, do you have any concerns?
So that's a lot of questions. Let me start with, I don't call it hair trigger, and you shouldn't either, but that's another story. So let's go back to, at the end of the Cold War, the foundational importance of our nuclear deterrent did not change. That foundational importance has remained from the end of the Cold War through to today. But in U.S. policy, what the policymakers said was, we're going to reduce the role of nuclear weapons, while in fact we made a lot of changes, practical changes to the force and its force posture. So a lot of the thinking about deterrence and a lot of the cottage industry in academia and elsewhere that used to accompany all of this declined. And in fact, we had a reduction in the experience base, even in the uniforms and out of the uniforms, with people who consider these issues. And so, you know, there was the peace dividend piece to all of this when we thought that we actually deferred investment in the nuclear force. We deferred modernization in the nuclear force. We deferred our attention to the people at the tip of the nuclear spear. That resulted in some problems for us that we had to reverse. And then 9/11 occurred. And of course, that diverted us in, and I'm not being critical of this, but for all the reasons that you would understand and we know, we diverted our attention for almost 20 years after 9/11 to other things. So now we find ourselves today in a place where modernization has been deferred way past end of life for a lot of these foundational systems. And so, given that we are going to continue to rely on deterrence as the foundation of our national security, and I believe that's still the right thing to do, then investment is required. And we've deferred it for so long that investment is going to be a bigger challenge than it would have been had we done this sequentially. We're now doing this simultaneously. And so this is a problem for the policymakers and the budget people and everybody else who is interested in this, to include nuclear command and control, which is the central nervous system for the entire system. So that gets to, what about this nuclear command and control system, and how do we make nuclear decisions? So let me say a couple of words about this. There's a professor at Duke University, Peter Feaver, who has captured the demand signal that the policymakers have placed on the nuclear command and control system in four words: always, never, civilian control. Those are three different pieces. It's not never civilian control. It's always, dash, never, dash, civilian control. All right. What's the always part? The always part is that the policymakers insist that nuclear forces be constantly connected to the senior decision maker here, which is the commander in chief, under all conditions of stress. That's the always part. That's a big ask. And particularly today, when we start talking about things like autonomy and where does artificial intelligence fit into this and fake news and other things that are out there where people are intentionally trying to spoof and other challenges that we have in systems today. I understand you had some trouble connecting to the internet here. Those are real issues that we need to go address in the always part. The never part is equally important, and that is that nuclear weapons can never be used accidentally, unintentionally, etc. And then the civilian control is they must always be under the control of our civilians. That's the way our system works. Our military is subservient to civilian authority, which is exactly the way it ought to be. So, how do we do that? And over time, beginning early in the Cold War, the civilian control part was basically all the authority to use nuclear weapons in combat was placed in the hands of the commander-in-chief, the President of the United States. For a while, beginning with Eisenhower, because they were worried about a decapitation strike that would take the president out of the system, there was delegation of authority to certain commanders in the field to use nuclear weapons under certain conditions. All of that went away. People asked me, they would say, so, did you have authority to use those weapons? I said, nope. Now, come on, you can tell me. It's a little bit like people asking me when I was Space Command about the aliens at Area 51. There are aliens out there, aren't there? No. Come on, you can tell me. No, the answer is no. The answer is no. Did you, commander of STRATCOM, have authority to use nuclear weapons in combat? No, I did not. Neither did any other subordinate commander below the level of the commander-in-chief. So, the commander-in-chief has sole authority. Only the President of the United States can authorize the use of U.S. nuclear weapons. Sometimes Congress questions that, and I've been asked that at a hearing after I retired, which was an uncomfortable hearing, actually, because what I said, but well, let me get into this in a second. So if Congress has an issue with the President's authority to use military force, then that's an Article 1, Article 2 of the Constitution issue for them to go resolve. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I am not a constitutional historian. But in my reading, I believe that Article 1, Article 2 issue has existed, let me think, since the Constitution was ratified. It's a question of the limits of presidential authority to employ military force. In this case, it happens to be nuclear weapons. I don't know what the policymakers would decide. But it's up to them to decide it. And then the military is going to do exactly what it is that they've decided. What we have today, though, I would say from a military perspective, is absolute clarity in the chain of command. Absolute clarity. And why is that important? Because another U.S. policy tenet of nuclear weapons is we must use them in accordance with the laws of armed conflict. That's true, by the way, with pulling the trigger on a rifle. Every U.S. military person must follow the law. And so I've been asked that before. The answer is, a more refined answer is, we don't sit there screening orders. They're presumed to be legal, but we don't blindly follow them either. I was only following orders was not an excuse at Nuremberg. It wasn't an excuse for Lieutenant Kelly. So, we've got to have absolute clarity because down there in that missile launch control center, I, as a crew member, I didn't have a way of knowing whether or not I was being given a legal order because I couldn't see the target. I had to trust the command chain. I had to trust that somebody up that chain had gone through the process of making sure that we were doing something that was in the interest of the nation and that what I was being told to do was legal. And what I knew for sure as a crew member was that everything that I was going to be ordered to do, potentially, hopefully never, but potentially, was through a screening process that I was going to be told to do something that was legal. And, oh, by the way, the United States of America has never said, nor do we agree, that nuclear weapons are inherently illegal or immoral. So, it's important that the people at the tip of the nuclear spear, I'm pointing down because that's where the ICBM silos are. It's also up there. It's also under the water. it's important that they understand that they can trust the chain of command. That's why, by the way, character is important in the chain of command, and that's why the service academies have the motto, we don't lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. It's all part of trust and confidence in the chain of command. People would say to me, well, you're not in the chain of command as the commander of STRATCOM, and my answer was, yes, I absolutely am in the chain of command. But the authority to use nuclear weapons doesn't flow down through the chain of command, if they're ever ordered to be used. It goes directly from the commander-in-chief to the forces. Now, we say directly to the forces. What we mean is the President of the United States, through a series of safeguards, would give an order. That order gets translated into a message that goes to the forces, and a command center has to do that. A senator said to me, so what are the safeguards there? So, well, there are safeguards, but there's no two-person control safeguard. Ha-ha, General, there's no two-person safeguard on the commander-in-chief. And the answer is, well, not the same two-person control. Positive control begins with the commander-in-chief. Two-person control begins below the commander-in-chief. Two-person control is not a command authority. A presidential order is a command authority. There's a difference. So at every other level, two people have to act in concert. They can monitor one another, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the level of the commander-in-chief's the decision maker for an order to use the weapons. And the commander-in-chief has that authority to order the use of military force in other cases as well. We don't split the authority, the command authority of the commander-in-chief. Again, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and you could probably quibble with me, and maybe there's a lawyer in the room who could tell me I'm wrong. But the fact of the matter is we have that process here that begins in the chain of command. If we were talking about a conventional operation, the commander-in-chief would order the military to go do something. A combatant commander would receive the order, translate that order down to the forces, etc. That's not the way we do this for nuclear weapons. And, oh, by the way, if nuclear weapons are ordered for use, there are specific weapons ordered for specific targets for a specific amount of time. Every other weapon remains under positive control. Are there safeguards in the system? There are safeguards everywhere. And ultimately, there's a de facto safeguard, and that's the legal process that an order would go through prior to it being ordered.
I understand that you believe that the system is quite clear. And I understand that you also, personal belief doesn't really matter because we have the Constitution. That's the way that these things are laid out. And this is a matter that Congress is going to have to sort out if it's going to. But personally, do you have issue? Have you had concern about the way that the president has this unilateral power?
I've not been concerned about that. I am confident in the process. And I am confident in the safeguards that exist. We go to extraordinary lengths. You know, people, and this gets back to the hair trigger thing. Hair trigger suggests that something unintentional could happen or something, there could be a misunderstanding. So you can't prevent misunderstandings, but what you can do is you can make sure that the process accounts for the possibility of a misunderstanding. You know, people cite the 1980 false alarm, you know, the tapes that got loaded by mistake and got transmitted out into the system. And it's a great story.
Maybe you should set that up a little bit.
Yeah, so NORAD was running an exercise, and they had loaded simulation tapes to display for the exercise. And for whatever reason, those got translated into actual displays.
So the military believed that there were incoming.
Yeah,
there was a
for a very short time there was confusion about what was happening here.
That there could have been a salvo from the Soviet Union,
right,
incoming to the United States.
Right. And that confusion didn't last very long. A matter of minutes.
It was a pretty important minutes, though.
No denying that. No denying that. And not acceptable, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying here, but it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. But I think the folklore that has gone with this is that we were that close, and that's not so. And the reason for that is the safeguards that go with it. So, you know, we rely on specially certified machines, but mostly what you need to know about the system is human beings are at every level. Human beings are ultimately decision makers here. Nothing happens automatically in the system. So at any rate, this was resolved. And then, of course, additional checks and balances were put in place after that. So there are safeguards at every level of the system. And we expend an enormous amount of time and energy to try as best we can humanly try to make sure that there aren't other faults in the system that could result in some unintentional activity.
That was General C. Robert Keller, USAF retired, who is a former commander of U.S. Strategic Command, and he was interviewed by W.J. Bill Hennigan, a correspondent for the New York Times Opinion, as part of last December's Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C. The second part of this interview was bumped by current events, but it's ready to go, dealing with nukes in space and nukes with AI. And we will have that for you on a future episode. Note that while the speaker comes from an assumption that deterrence is a key factor in the continuance of nuclear weapons, and in his words, quote, "We are going to continue to rely on deterrence as the foundation of our national security, and I believe that's still the right thing to do." We at Nuclear Hot Seat respectfully disagree. To counter the widespread belief in deterrence, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons has created a one-sheet entitled Five Myths of Nuclear Deterrence. These are excerpts. Myth number one, nuclear deterrence keeps us safe. The fact that nuclear deterrence could fail is undeniable. And when the probability of failure is more than zero, it puts everything at risk. Nuclear deterrence does not keep anyone safe. It is a threat to all of us. Myth number two, nuclear deterrence keeps the peace. There is no evidence that nuclear weapons deter war beyond the correlation of their existence with the fact that they have not been used in warfare again since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. During the Cold War, we now know it was a combination of luck and the decisions of individuals prepared to defy established procedures that prevented nuclear war, particularly during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and in Europe in the early 1980s. Assertions that nuclear deterrence keeps the peace fail to consider other contributing factors. Myth number three, nuclear deterrence is purely defensive. Deterrence doctrine is inherently aggressive. It requires being ready at all times to use nuclear weapons if or when an incoming attack is detected, and it would do massive, indiscriminate harm to millions of people, including people and countries that have nothing to do with the conflict. Myth number four, nuclear deterrence is normal. It is not normal for nine countries to assert the right to cause catastrophic harm to every living thing on Earth at a moment's notice. Nuclear deterrence cannot be compared with people carrying knives or guns or threatening retaliation to scare off potential assailants. If, or more likely when, nuclear weapons are used, it will have a devastating impact on the whole world, not just a few individuals. And myth number five, everyone believes in nuclear deterrence. Devotion to deterrence doctrine is a minority pursuit. According to the 122 countries that have already voted to adopt the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, they reject deterrence doctrine and believe the only way to prevent the use of nuclear weapons is to ban them outright. The countries that have signed or ratified the TPNW or supported in votes at the United Nations number around 140 out of the 193 countries represented there. The states that continue to believe in nuclear deterrence are a minority. Again, these are excerpts from the ICAN one sheet, Five Myths of Nuclear Deterrence. We will have a link to it and a downloadable PDF on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 723. On this show, we can't talk about nuclear war without including voices for peace. To that end, first, here is Dr. Ira Halfand, board member of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, or IPPNW. This was his speech just last week at the Third Preparatory Committee for the 2026 Review Conference of the Parties to the Treaty on the Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT. It took place at the United Nations headquarters on April 30, 2025.
My name is Ira Helfand. I'm speaking for the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. It is late, you are tired, and I'm not a diplomat. I'm an emergency room doctor, and I've spent the last 50 years speaking with patients and their families. So forgive me, please, if I speak to you rather bluntly about as though I were speaking to the family of a critically ill patient, because that is the situation that we find ourselves in. The world for which we are collectively responsible is in terrible danger. 9 countries, 5 of which are parties to this treaty, have chosen to build arsenals of nuclear weapons that effectively hold all of humanity, including their own citizens, hostage. They want these weapons because they make them strong and allow them to bully the rest of the world. They justify these weapons by claiming that they offer security. That is a dangerous lie. These weapons do not offer security. They are the greatest threat to our security, to our survival, and they pose an existential threat to human civilization. Like the chronic smoker who lives in denial about the risk of developing lung cancer, we have all largely convinced ourselves that nuclear war will never happen. The truth is, we are closer to nuclear war today than we have ever been, and yet we go about our daily lives as though this danger did not exist, as though this sword of Damocles did not hang over us. Studies have shown that a large-scale nuclear war between the United States and Russia, who together possess nearly 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, would end life as we know it. Most of this city, including the building we are sitting in, would be vaporized, and 12 to 15 million people would simply disappear. Across both countries, an estimated 200 to 300 million people would be killed in the first half hour. Survivors would be left in a radioactive wasteland with no electric grid, no internet, no cell phones, no health care, no food distribution system, no banking system, no system for maintaining law and order. And in the following months, most of those who survived the initial attack would also die from radiation poisoning, epidemic disease, exposure, and starvation. But that's only part of the story. The impacts of this war would ripple far beyond the borders of the United States and Russia. The enormous fires that consume the cities of these countries would loft millions of tons of soot into the upper atmosphere, blocking out the sun and causing global temperatures to plummet by an average of 10 degrees centigrade. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, the temperatures would drop 25 to 30 degrees centigrade. We have not seen conditions on this planet that cold since the last ice age. And under these conditions, ecosystems that have evolved since the end of that ice age will collapse, food production will stop, and according to a landmark study published in 2022, 6 billion people, 3/4 of humanity, will starve in the first 2 years. The study stopped at 2 years. The famine would continue, and we do not know what the ultimate death toll would be. The same study showed that even a much smaller war, as might take place between India and Pakistan, will cause enough climate disruption to trigger a famine that will kill 1/4 of humanity, 2 billion people globally, in the first 2 years. The nuclear powers assure us that this will never happen, that deterrence will prevent nuclear weapons from being used. Incredibly, they push this myth, even as they threaten to use these very weapons. The truth is that nuclear weapons do not possess some magical power that guarantees they will never be used. In fact, there have been numerous instances throughout the nuclear weapons era when we have come within minutes of the Holocaust I have just described. We have not survived because deterrence works, because our leaders have been all wise, our military policies and doctrines sound, and our technology perfect. We have survived, to use the words of former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, because, and I'm quoting him, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. Five of the nine nuclear powers have a binding obligation under Article 6 of this treaty to engage in good faith negotiations for the elimination of nuclear weapons. Yet they have ignored this obligation for six decades. The U.S. and Russia have actually gone further, abandoning every nuclear arms control agreement except for New START, and that will expire next February. These failures, taken together with the destabilizing and deadly wars in Ukraine and Gaza, are causing some non-nuclear parties to the NPT to seek access to nuclear weapons. When 120 non-nuclear nations came together to uphold Article 6 of this treaty and negotiated the new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, the nuclear armed states chose not to join that historic effort, but to boycott the negotiations and do everything they could to undermine the new treaty, using the bizarre claim straight out of 1984's Ministry of Truth that somehow the TPNW undermined the NPT. This review conference needs to call out their horrific failure to honor their Article 6 obligations. The nine nuclear armed states should address any concerns they have with the TPNW by meaningfully engaging with states' parties and joining the treaty's official proceedings. They must come together, agree to a detailed timetable to eliminate their nuclear arsenals, adhere to the TPNW's provisions, and join that treaty at the earliest possible date. The world is at a crossroads. We have before us the choice of life or death. You, distinguished delegates, have a huge responsibility in this situation. You must demand the nuclear armed states uphold their Article 6 obligations, and you must not allow them to lead us down the path to death.
Dr. Ira Helfand of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, addressing the impact of nuclear war, and presciently calling out the significance should India and Pakistan decide to resort to nuclear weapons. We will have a link up to the United Nations video of his speech entitled, Do Not Let the Nuclear Armed States Lead Us Down the Path to Death. There will also be a link to a PDF of his text on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 723. In the wake of the latest escalation of tensions between Pakistan and India, peace and anti-nuclear groups have issued strongly worded warnings in the hope, if not the expectation, of mainstream media picking up on their perspective. First, a statement from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. It states, ICAN is gravely concerned at the escalating hostilities between India and Pakistan, particularly since last night's missile strikes by India on Pakistan-administered Kashmir and Pakistan, and Pakistan's previous threats to use nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are not a deterrent. Far from preserving stability, they introduce the risk of catastrophic escalation to any conflict. A nuclear war between India and Pakistan would cause millions of immediate deaths in the region and have severe global consequences. As the 2022 Nature Food Study by Jia Robach et al. Shows, even a, quote, limited, end quote, nuclear war between two countries could trigger a nuclear winter, drastically disrupting global agriculture, leading to famine that could kill more than 2 billion people. No country would be spared. No government could protect its people from the consequences. This is exactly why nuclear weapons must be eliminated. ICAN calls on both governments to show utmost restraint and de-escalate, and calls on the international community to redouble efforts towards disarmament through the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Both nations should immediately commit not to use nuclear weapons in this conflict. However, the only enduring way to guarantee these weapons are never used is to eliminate them. That's the statement from ICAN. And from a press release also sent out earlier today, this one from International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, or IPPNW, It's under the headline, International Physicians Call for Immediate Ceasefire in South Asia, warn of danger of, quote, catastrophic nuclear conflict. It reads, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW, called for an immediate ceasefire in South Asia after an initial round of cross-border attacks by India and Pakistan early Wednesday morning, South Asia time. IPPNW Executive Director Michael Crist said, conflict between these two nuclear-armed states carries the risk of a catastrophic nuclear conflict. The world might be lucky and dodge the nuclear bullet again, but we cannot continue to play nuclear roulette like this. The only way to guarantee that we do not stumble into a nuclear holocaust is to eliminate these weapons before they eliminate us. IPPNW urged all nations to join the nearly 100 states that have already signed on to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, and pledge now, as they engage in that process, never to use their nuclear arsenals. And Dr. Arun Mitra, the president of Indian Doctors for Peace and Development, IPPNW's Indian affiliate, echoed the call for an immediate end to the fighting. Quote, we must resolve all issues in this conflict through negotiations, he said. The people of India and Pakistan do not want to destroy each other. Our leaders must seek the path to peace. Now to see whether anyone listens. By the time this episode of Nuclear Hot Seat hits the air, there will undoubtedly be many other statements from peace organizations around the world reminding us what could go wrong, how bad it would get, and why we need to get rid of nuclear weapons before they get rid of us. This is a breaking story, and we will have follow-up reports in the coming weeks. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Wednesday, May 7, 2025. Let's make certain that from this point on, you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. And it's easy to get it delivered via email every week. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and in the big yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one, just one email, with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. In this way, you will never miss a single beat of the nuclear drumbeat. Now, we rely on listeners to bring us up to date on what the local stories are in your area. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help in order to stay in business. No amount is too small, no amount is too large. Anything helps, and we really will appreciate and be grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Dr. Ira Halfand of IPPNW just stated, do not let the nuclear-armed states lead us down the path to death. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.